To his utter surprise, he found that he enjoyed learning. He actually began to work hard at his studies. He wanted to excel. And there was always Mars, hovering in the background of his thoughts, hanging just over the horizon of his existence. He would forget about it for long months, for years even, and then suddenly a news broadcast would show another rocket lifting off in a roar of flame and steam to carry a robot landing vehicle to the red planet. Or a guest lecturer would speak on the problems of medicine in the microgravity environment of a space station and mention in passing the similar problems to be encountered on a mission to Mars. Or Alberto Brumado, gray now, but still sparkling with youthful zeal, would host a telly special about the origin of life on Earth and ask wistfully if it were possible that life had arisen on Mars, too. His father was shocked and angered when Tony refused to step into the family practice. Red-faced, portly with years and too much living, sputtering with rage, his father wrote, "I've spent my entire life building up this practice. You must carry it on." Tony smiled coolly, trying to hide the terror that his father's wrath always stirred inside him. "Father, there's nothing for it. I am not going to follow in your sacred footsteps."
"What's the matter with you?" his father roared. "Afraid of a little blood? Is that it? Surgery scares the liver out of you, eh? Damned sniveling coward."
Tony stood his ground.
"By God! At your age, I was sewing up wounded men on a hospital ship in the middle of the South Atlantic winter storms."
"You've told us of your glorious exploits in the Falklands War many times, father."
"You're a coward! A damned, trembling, shaking little coward!"
The old man turned on his wife.
"You've raised a coward for a son."
Tony felt his blood turn to flame. "Don't bully her." His father stared at him for a long moment. Then, with an exasperated grunt, he stormed out of the room. Tony turned to his mother, sitting silently, patiently. They heard the front door open and then slam shut. "You don't think I'm a coward, do you?" Tony asked his mama. "Of course not, dear." 2 days later, Tony applied for a post in the British government's space program. Within a fortnight, he received notification that he had been tentatively accepted. He was to report to the training center for tests and evaluation. His father was not home when the letter came. There was no one in the house except Tony and his mother. "They need physicians," he told her, still aching with wounded pride. "I may very well be selected for the Mars training team if Britain joins the program." He had expected that she would be horrified, break into tears, beg him to reconsider. Instead, his mother smiled and kissed him on the forehead and told him that whatever he wanted to do was what he should do. In the end, Tony was accepted by the Mars Project. A stranger bought the lucrative practice when his father retired, and his mother dragged the old man off to Nassau, where he suffered an incapacitating stroke their first year in the sun, leaving him helpless and totally dependent on the loving care of his long-neglected wife. Tony loved being part of the Mars Project. Most of the other trainees were either astronauts or scientists, dullard technicians, or researchers so narrowly specialized that they knew practically nothing of the larger world of the arts and society. Tony enjoyed himself immensely, the sophisticated center of attraction and interest at all times. While others worried themselves into near hysteria over the selection process, Tony never doubted that he would be picked to go to Mars. If he feared the thought of riding millions of miles through space to an empty, harshly inhospitable world, he kept such apprehensions to himself. Only in his dreams did such terrors confront him, and then it was always in the shape of his father, looming over him like a horrible, devouring ogre, while his mother wept helplessly. During his waking hours, Tony made only one move that he would consider a mistake. He helped Joanna to get rid of Hoffman and bring the Navajo along with them to Mars. A blunder, Tony considered it in retrospect. The Navajo has become the center of everyone's attention, even Joanna's. Especially Joanna's. Sol 24, noon. Alexander Mironov hummed softly as he checked Jamie's backpack. The rover's airlock was crowded with just the two of them in it. Mironov in his fire engine red hard suit, Jamie in his sky blue, with a gray spare helmet to replace his meteorite-gouged original. Mironov's visor was up, and Jamie could see that the Russian was smiling as he clumped back into his view. Mironov's face looked chunky, almost compressed in his helmet, as if stuffed into a container a half size too small. It was a broad-cheeked, snub-nosed face, slightly ruddy, sprinkled lightly with freckles, with pale blue eyes and eyebrows so fair they were barely visible.
"Gloves?"
Mironov asked.
"Right here on my belt, Alex."
Jamie tugged them on. Of all the equipment on the mission, the gloves were the most advanced piece of technology. Thin enough to be easily flexible and give the wearer a good feel for whatever he grasped, yet tough enough to protect the hands against the near vacuum of the Martian atmosphere.
"Visor down,"
Mironov said. Only after they had both sealed their helmets did he turn to the pumps and start them chugging.
"You look tired,"
the cosmonaut said over the suit-to-suit radio. Surprised, Jamie said to the gold-tinted visor,
"I feel okay. You were outside 4 hours yesterday, then you stayed up very late last night. You were outside all morning, and now you go again."
The pumps stopped. The indicator light turned red. Mironov pushed the hatch open.
"We've only got 3 days here,"
Jamie replied, as they stepped through the hatch and down the short ladder to the rough, blackened ground.
"We've got to make the most of them. Patel makes you feel guilty."
Jamie forgot himself and tried to shrug inside the suit. All he got for his effort was a fresh irritation under his armpit where the suit chafed him.
"You must not drive yourself so hard,"
Mironov went on.
"When you are tired, you make mistakes. Mistakes can kill a man." "I'll be all right. The others are pushing just as hard,"
Jamie said.
"I gave them the same lecture,"
said the Russian. His voice sounded more disappointed than distressed.
"And?"
Jamie asked. Mironov pointed a gloved finger toward the butter-yellow and dark-green figures of Patel and Nagib.
"They ignored me, just as you are ignoring me."
Patel and Nagib were already chipping samples of the dark basaltic rock that spread as far as the eye could see. Old lava flow, Jamie knew. Pavonis Mons had erupted over and over again, red-hot magma flowing in all directions. How long ago? The samples they were taking would give them the answer. They had decided to spend these 3 precious days at the base of the volcano's shield, collecting as many samples from as many different locations as possible. They would start to analyze them on the trek back to the base, they had agreed. Yet none of the 3 scientists could resist testing the samples they had collected. Last night they had stayed up for hours, while Mironov reminded them of the mission schedule like an ineffectual camp counselor. They ran 12 samples through the portable GCMS in the rover's lab module. The mass spectrometer told them that their samples were iron-rich basalts, no more than 500 million years old, based on their ratio of potassium to argon. But the argon might have outgassed, Jamie warned. Some of it may have escaped into the atmosphere. "Much of it may be missing," Nagib agreed. "Which means that the samples could be much older," said Jamie. Patel, still refusing to meet Jamie's eyes, said to the Egyptian,
"We will run more definitive tests back at the base, where we can irradiate the samples in the power reactor."
Nagib nodded and said,
"Yes, if the remote handling system is working." "It was down. Pete said he'd have it running by the time we got back," Jamie said.
"Astronaut Connors,"
Patel almost snorted.
"He spends all his time flying the RPV instead of attending to maintenance."
"Pete will have the remote handlers working by the time we get back," Jamie insisted. Finally, they folded down their bunks for sleep. Patel and Nagib on the uppers, Mironov and Jamie below. Jamie fell asleep quickly, only to be awakened by a whining, almost sobbing sound from above. One of them's having a nightmare, he realized. He turned his face toward the curving wall of the rover and went back to sleep. His last conscious thought was that the metal skin of the vehicle felt cold. The freezing night of Mars waited outside, less than an inch away. Over breakfast, they had agreed that their best strategy was to work along the line of fissures and sinkholes that ran up one side of the volcano's massive base. They would go as far as they could up the gentle slope of the shield, with Mironov driving the rover behind them, so they would not exceed the safe walk-back distance specified in the mission regulations.
All three of these volcanoes sit astride this big fault line, Jamie said to himself as he laboriously